Today on Movie Rollers, we talk about Free Fire and their finest. It's time for Movie Rollers. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Rollers is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you.
We're back home.
We are indeed. Yay. From Tribeca Film Festival.
Yes. Which was super.
It was really good this year.
It was great. And it's always fun spending time with you guys too.
Yes.
It's always fun hanging out.
Yeah. Because we don't hang out so much otherwise. You know, we watch movies.
Okay, good. I thought you were being sarcastic then, Yazdi.
No, I wasn't being sarcastic. We watch movies and then we're staring at a dark screen.
This is true.
And then we record and then we go our individual
ways. Then we go our separate ways, yes.
And anyone who knows me knows I love slumber. I love the idea of like slumber parties. So yes, Tribeca is like one big slumber party, isn't it?
It is. I was pretty bleary. No. bleary-eyed.
How is it one big slumber party?
Because we get to like be in our pajamas and hang out and talk about movies and eat food.
Well,
it's the food eating.
The pajama piece comes only during the recording. we're not wandering around New York in our pajamas watching movies.
Say that.
It came across that way.
Okay, moving on swiftly.
But no, it is fun. I mean, it's kind of an intense few days. I mean, covering the film festival is terrific fun, but you know, just not to request anyone's pity for the fun that we had.
I know. I dare not.
But yeah, it's intense. I mean, we get to New York, we're a little bit jet lagged, and then we have pretty early starts. I mean, the screenings start at 9 a.m., which doesn't sound too early unless you are coming in from the West Coast with a 3-hour time difference. And like literally we have to kind of get out of the hotel, get ourselves to the movie theater, and then it's pretty much full on movie watching until 3-4 in the afternoon, at which point we get some food to eat, and then there's usually an evening screening, and then we have to get more food to eat and come back and record in the hotel, which is fine, but it's like,
okay, just stop while you're ahead.
4-5 days of that, which is great fun but exhausting. So yeah, anyway, good fun.
Yes, but glad to be back and talking about more movies.
Yes.
Which you can all watch.
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, the idea is hopefully all of the things that we watched at Tribeca you can eventually watch. I mean, that's the goal. I think they always do a good job picking stuff. It is very frustrating to me continually at these film festivals that stuff that we see doesn't necessarily make it out into other outlets. So some will make it into the movie theatres. I think The Lovers, Rashmi, is going to get a big release, which is terrific.
Yes.
But some of it takes years.
Yeah.
I mean, there's stuff from last year's Tribeca that is finally making its way to theatres.
Yeah, and I know. Yes, these Netflix pickers
is one that we loved from last year. Yeah. And it almost seems like, the very fact that the new Tribeca Film Festival is coming up sort of goads people whose movies were shown in last year's Tribeca to somehow find distribution. Because it almost seems like by the time the next year's comes along, a lot of the movies shown previous year get released.
Yeah. And I'm pleased to say that one I watched last year called Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent, about the super chef who kind of invented, you know, master chefs in a sense.
Are we
or
segueing?
Fine dining. That movie's actually being released. It's getting a release very shortly.
Terrific. So let's move straight into our movie, rather our usual weekly segment that we try and do, which is I Can't Find Anything to Watch on Netflix. And the reason we do this is because despite the wealth of content on Netflix, there's some great TV now, actually, which I think a lot of people find themselves distracted in. And let's not forget, there's, you know, Netflix is about movies, not just these, you know, episodic content that they keep pushing out. It's a great venue and a great opportunity for distribution for films that may not have made it. So I know, Yazdi, I think one of yours is on the film festival list from last year.
Yes, it was maybe one of my top three films from last year. I think we all uniformly fell in love with it. It's a movie called Little Boxes. And
I didn't see this one.
Only you and I saw it yesterday.
Yeah, I missed that screening, so that's terrific. Because I remember you guys raving.
It's so good. And I think, not to get political, but I think especially where we are right now, where we are kind of a nation divided, it's even more critical. It's about this interracial couple played by Melanie Lynskey and Nelson Ellis. He's black, she's white. Who live in Brooklyn, and then they decide that they are going to move to a fairly suburban neighborhood in Washington State because, you know, he's going to have a better job. So, you know, they're completely used to the Brooklyn lifestyle where everything is fine, everybody's accepted, and they move to this very, very, you know, picket fence neighborhood in the middle of suburbia in Washington State. And the movie's about them getting used to them as much as the people in their new environs getting used to it. And I think it would have been so easy for this movie to show that the new environment they've gone to is backward and, you know, rednecky or whatever. But it does not take that shortcut out. It just presents, you know, a fish out of water story. It just presents how do you acclimatize with an environment that is so different from yours. And it's ultimately about acceptance and about finding yourself in a new place. And they have a son who's played by Armani Jackson.
Who is gorgeous.
Who is, yeah, I mean, he should be when he gets bigger, he should be a big, big star. But he is the heart of the movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, he gets into this very unusual relationship with a white girl who we don't know what her intentions are. And he's almost forced to act more black because he's in a predominantly white neighborhood and he's never known how to do it. And I make this sound like bitter medicine, but it's beautiful and it's funny and it's awkward. And, you know, it's got the lovely Melanie Lynskey, who we never see enough of in movies. It's just it's a big hug of a movie. You really need to see Little Boxes.
Yeah, and it's one of those that could have easily, and I think we said this during the review, it's one that could be easily so precious, but it really shies away from being so precious, and it stays real, and it stays authentic, and that's very difficult to do when you're showing a mixed-race couple. Yeah. So yeah, great choice, Yazdi, and so happy that a film festival movie's got distribution of some sort.
Yeah.
Is it a comedy?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. It sounds like kind of a comedic premise, but, you know, is the movie, you know, meant to be a kind of an all-out, you know, laugh fest, or is it one of those that's kind of tonally touching on real points? And
yeah, I'd say it's a dramedy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is funny while being authentic in describing the situation, but it intends to be funny. It's not intending to lecture you at all.
Okay.
There's no lecturing. It's all played for laughs, but never just as a giggle. I mean, it's very authentic.
Terrific stuff.
Yeah.
Rashmi, what's your pick?
So my pick is actually a movie that I reviewed on our website a few months ago, and it's called Strike a Pose, and I'm really happy that it's come on Netflix and it's available for everyone to watch. And this is actually the movie of the seven dancers that were part of the Truth or Dare film that Madonna did back in 1990, which was her tour of the same name. And now, you know, 25 years later, they've got together and they're talking about what it was to be part of that tour and how it changed their lives and the bonds they made. And there was a very famous court case that occurred and Madonna stopped speaking to these people, yet they were all like a family. And, you know, two of the dancers are actually the inventors of voguing, the famous dance that obviously Madonna made famous in her video Vogue, but that was around for many years before she discovered it. So it's a really nice movie about, I would say, relationships and about a time.
Yeah, no, I watched this one with you as well. I mean, I this was not one that I fully focused on, so I'm not going to review it per se, but it's one of those wonderful behind the scenes, behind the music, the where are they now kind of thing. And it's very touching what kind of transpires over time to these people who have this very intense moment of pseudo-fame. You know, they were never famous because they were, you know, they were behind Madonna on this tour. It's kind of like the 20 feet from stardom type moment, but with respect to Madonna's dancers and the intense relationships that they forged over this very bizarre scenario of being on a world tour with a megastar.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. And
Yeah. Good documentary. And yours, Joe?
My pick is a movie called Tower. This is one of the... I believe it was nominated last year.
Last year, yes.
During award season for various things. It's a documentary directed by Keith Maitland. And it is about an incident that I actually was not very familiar with. Based on August 1st, 1966, a sniper had basically rode the elevator to the top floor of the University of Texas Tower and opened fire. He held the campus hostage for 96 minutes. And I believe a lot of people were actually shot and injured by this. But this was one of the first, incidences of a school shooting. You know, this thing that has been all too commonplace now within our society. We have, one crazy shooter after another, it seems, at the moment. I won't get political on you, but this is certainly one of the first incidences where somebody with a gun decides to take pot shots at public, and it's told in this kind of really odd documentary fashion. It's really done with interviews and clips, but they do this really clever
animation
mm-hmm. style. I don't know if it's kind of filmed footage and animated rotoscoped. That's irrelevant, but it creates this very haunting. And have you guys seen it? I know, Rashmi, you've seen it, but yes,
I have not seen it.
It creates this very kind of haunting set of images that, it's not, because it was 1966, there weren't, cell phones and cameras everywhere to kind of tell the story. So, what they've done here is they've kind of recreated it, but rather than do it cheesily with, actors playing it, the animation kind of gives it a more of a reality. And it's a lot of people who were shot and injured that day, depiction of what was a very cruel, the classic sniper trick is to shoot somebody and injure them, and then as people come to rescue them, you then inflict more damage. It's one of those kind of military tactics that's used. That's what snipers do. That's their role. It's to take out as many enemy as possible. But he did this to on a school campus, and it's tragic. A very, very powerful, moving documentary, and definitely worth an hour and a half of your time. The movie left me kind of deeply affected. And it's, like I say, it's something that I hadn't seen before. I was not aware of this particular occurrence.
Yeah, just the style of it is something unusual.
Yeah, I mean,
it takes a little bit of getting used to, but then you kind of forget that you're watching this animation on top of real film, in a sense.
Yeah, they and they use, the use of color in it is very striking. And but let's not, it's really just a way of depicting interviews in a way that also helps us visualize exactly what it might have been like in those moments. So, very, very powerful movie. It's called Tower, not The Tower or A Tower. It's just called Tower. And amazingly, it's 100% on Rotten Tomatoes here after 73 reviews counted. So, I think it has an effect on everyone that watches it. It's very, very moving. Okay, so those are our Netflix picks for the week. We have, again, just to recap, Little Boxes, Yazdi, your pick. Rashmi, your pick was...
Striker Pose.
And my pick was Tower. Go see all of those now on Netflix.
You couldn't do bad with any of those.
No.
Yeah, no, it's... It's always a delight to kind of see what's there, and you have to dig a little bit. I mean, the thing that I'm finding, maybe Netflix, if you're listening, is that
Mr. Netflix,
it's kind of hard for some of these movies to bubble up to the surface. Yeah. I mean, they're all there. I tend to watch Netflix on an Apple TV. I think there's different interfaces, but it you have to go digging a little bit, which is kind of why we do this.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think what they're doing now, unfortunately, is just like kind of throwing you a front page that has all this stuff on it, and a lot of it is TV-based, TV shows, because I think that's how they think they're going to keep people engaged by watching these, having these binge-worthy shows. They actually call them binge-worthy TV.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would be nice if there was a section that could be curated better for movie. If you're listening, Netflix.
I'm sure they're working on this
stuff. Movie are willing to help you.
Yeah, I'd be interested in the stats. I mean, we do watch a lot of episodic content ourselves, so... I wonder what proportion of Netflix viewing is movies versus TVs. I mean, it started off as a movie service, but, we find ourselves, often watching the episodic content too. So.
Yeah.
But movies are there, and movies are what we love. So go watch them too. Okay, speaking of movies, we have two to review this week. We have Free Fire and Their Finest. Where shall we start?
Their Finest.
So director Lone Scherfig burst into the international movie scene with her film An Education a few years ago. And it also brought to us the wonderful Carey Mulligan, who was nominated for Best Actress that year. Since then, she has made other movies. Specifically, I believe she directed... what did she direct? Last year, Lone Scherfig had directed a movie called The Riot Club. And then ahead of that, she had directed something called The Astronaut Wives Club. And here she is now with her third film, which is called Their Finest. And this movie essentially, I believe, is a period drama. And the IMDb write-up for it provides this summary, which is that a former secretary, played presumably by Gemma Arterton, newly appointed as a scriptwriter for propaganda films, joins the cast and crew of a major production while the blitz rages around them. So I presume this is around the World War time frame, and it's got, like I said, Gemma Arterton, Sam Claflin, and the wonderful, underappreciated, not nearly seen enough, Bill Nighy.
Yes.
So I didn't see this film. I missed the screening, but I believe the both of you did. Tell us about Their Finest.
So this is a movie about making movies, and it's about today. It's very relevant to today, but it's based in the 40s. So
you're going to have to explain that.
Yeah, so basically, I think, you know, at its core, it's about a group of people who are making a movie in the time of war. And it's, you know, the War Office has basically said that, you know, it's important for us to show feel-good movies about how the Brits are doing in the war against Germany. And so this group of people have been brought together. So that's an interesting premise, that this group of people have to make meaningful, and they're really concerned about making meaningful movies, not just, you know, twaddle.
But it's
propaganda at its core. Yeah, so that's interesting, right? That's an interesting premise. And then a lot of the attitudes that are kind of explored about, you know, gender and relationship and class are very relevant, or they haven't changed. I can't decide which. Mm. To today's attitudes in some ways, but it's definitely set in the 1940s, and the production is beautiful. So all in all, I enjoyed this movie in the moment, although it completely evaporated from my mind, you know, in the week since we've seen it.
Mm. And, you know, kind of less so from me. I mean, I think in the sense of it evaporating, this movie's somewhat stayed with me. I think it's a very fine period piece. I mean, you know, it's called Their Finest, and I think it's a very fine look at what life was like during the Blitz in London. You know, it doesn't get awfully heavy with the kind of the bombing and the raids, but you can see the effect that, and I think this was partly the intent of the movie, when life is being destroyed all around you almost randomly and without guidance, without any, you know, real reason, a bomb might fall on your head tomorrow. And so I think it changes the way a lot of people look at their relationships in their life. And I think, you know, the screenwriting propaganda stuff was a very nice backdrop to what was really just a kind of a gentle love story. And, you know, the movie does a very fine job of placing you in that moment in time. It's got some lovely characters and wonderful performances. I think Gemma Arterton,
great performances, yeah.
Arterton, sorry, is incredible in this movie. I mean, she carries a lot of it. The movie is definitely, you know, shot from her perspective and from her eyes. And, you know, ultimately, I think there's, you know, kind of a predictable subplot romance, or rather, well, the main plot romance is a little predictable, but it's a very enjoyable movie simply because it places you at a point in time and does a nice job of kind of giving you the sense of what it was like in London in 1941 or 40, whatever it was.
So the production design's very good.
Fantastic.
Mm. Yes, no, for sure. I mean, you know, there's military uniforms, there's a lot of film stuff. It feels, you know, a lot of the movie takes part almost on film sets.
Yeah.
And in the writer's room. It does a really great job of conveying the difficulties that a writer might have in telling a story a particular way. It does a very good job in talking about propaganda and spin. So, you know, there is, for example, there is a story of heroism that is portrayed during the Dunkirk landings. Yeah, upcoming movie by Chris Nolan.
I thought you would do that.
But the movie indicates that there is a certain falsehood that is, you know, I don't want to get too deep into it. I think it's a nice part of the story here. But there's a certain falsehood about the real story. Mm. And yet the War Office felt the need to tell the story anyway. And so, you know, writing around that without telling obvious lies to the British people, but still giving them that kind of, you know, stiff upper lip British, you know, pride in us versus them, as it tends to be with the war. And, you know, the fact that the movie wants to have an American audience because they're trying to bring America into the war to some extent and get support of the American people. Lots of little interesting touches. I believe it's a work of fiction. I'm not sure that this is a true story, but it feels very real and it feels very time appropriate.
It's very authentic. And again, I think really Gemma Arterton is pretty amazing. But the other one that really impressed me was Sam Claflin, who plays the main protagonist in the movie. He caught my attention in The Riot Club from a few years ago. But, you know, he's been in a few things. He's come in Which Like Me Before You. Which was also directed
by, yeah.
But he showed some, and he was in all the Hunger Game. He was the Finnick character in all of the Hunger Game movies. But here he showed real depth and real emotion without being over the top. So like there's this slow burning love story which doesn't quite, you know, it's not the focus of the movie, but it's there.
I disagree.
And it kind
I think
of,
that the movie's very much about that with the other stuff written around.
Okay. Great. Yeah. Very nice movie. I would say this is a very nice movie. I mean, I can sum it up. You know, this is a solid 7 out of 10 for me. It's a, you know, you won't be bored watching this. And it's beautiful. And Bill Nighy is great. We didn't even talk about Bill Nighy, but he's great. He's great in any movie. He's always Bill Nighy, though. You know, he doesn't really bring anything different to the table. Right. He brings Bill Nighy to the table, and it's always great to see him.
Yeah, this is a good example of him being cast because he is Bill Nighy.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't really have much to add there to your summation, Rashmi. I mean, I think it's a very good watch. It's a very pleasing movie. It's not particularly memorable's not the right word, but it's not a movie that's going to win any awards anytime soon, even though it is beautifully shot and beautifully directed, simply because I think it has kind of a very homely feel to it. You know, it doesn't aspire to be a big epic story in any way. I think it just tells a story very well. So 7 out of 10 for me as well. That feels extraordinarily stingy because I did enjoy the movie very much, but you know, it's you know, good movie set in wartime.
Okay.
And then movie number two, I guess, this week is something completely different. And let's talk about the movie Free Fire. So.
Yep, so Free Fire is a movie that's set in Boston in 1978, where a meeting in a deserted warehouse between two gangs turns into a shootout and a game of survival. So this is directed by Ben Wheatley, and it's written by Amy Jump and Ben Wheatley. And it stars Charlita Copley, Brie Larson, Armie Hammer, Enzo Silenti, Sam Riley, Michael Smiley, Cillian Murphy, right? Cillian Murphy, Babu Cisse, I just wanted to say Babu, Noah Taylor, and Jack Rayner, amongst a few others. And Ben Wheatley, interestingly, is someone who I came across when I watched this movie a few years ago called Sightseers. And I actually put a review of this on our website as well.
You did.
So
that was one of your written reviews, wasn't it?
One of my written reviews, yeah, which was a great movie, by the way. So I was interested to see this movie. So
and he also made High Rise last
that's
year.
That's right.
Which is a very divisive movie.
So, Yesdi, what did you think of Free Fire?
So I love this movie. I really do. The movie has a lot of things going on. It's clearly paying homage to a particular time and a particular sensibility.
And a particular Tarantino movie.
Maybe. I mean, I guess, you know, Reservoir Dogs more than anything else. But I think it also has kind of a... I don't know, it has those John Carpenter kind of... I felt like a John Carpenter Assault on Precinct 13 kind of vibe to it as well. But I think what I really liked about the movie is that it's just fun in a bottle. I mean, you uncork this bottle and fizz, you just have fun for 2 hours straight. And it's hard to do a good, kind of smart, funny movie. Now, you could always say, we've seen this before, it's tiresome, whatever. I was just on the edge of my seat the whole time. I was like a kid in an amusement park. I love that the movie sustained a sense of foreboding and imminent danger. It was, the whole movie felt like a bomb about to detonate for me at any minute. And it does detonate over and over again, but it was just, oh, so much fun. I loved it.
Joe?
Yeah, no, I like this one a lot as well. I mean, the bomb description is actually pretty apt, because half the time I didn't know who was shooting whom and why and for what. And it does the violence in this really wonderful comedic way. And I say comedic in the sense that oftentimes in movies, somebody gets shot and, you know, they clasp their hands over their chest, they fall down backwards and they're dead. Here, everyone's just getting hurt constantly through the movie. And they're not fatal injuries, or they're injuries that are not immediately fatal. So despite the fact that somebody has been shot, they then spend the rest of the movie on screen, you know, describing and dealing with some of the issues that they have from their injuries. So it's done in a very comedic way. I mean, it's unlike anything I can recall immediately. I mean, the Reservoir Dogs reference that I made earlier on, I think, is the most... It has that pressure cooker, constant kind of Mexican standoff type moments. But yeah, just a lot of fun. I didn't know where the hell it was going at any time in the movie. And it was very, very satisfying fun to watch.
This is a hyper-violent, crazy caper, which I just loved. This is my type of movie. This is reminiscent of something like Seven Psychopaths in its sensibility. I love Charlize Copley. I love Armie Hammer. I love Brie Larson. I love Cillian Murphy. This is just a ridiculous, tense, incredibly funny caper that unfolds. And it doesn't matter whose side anyone is on. It's just funny to watch it unfold. And I really like the production. Like, the production is funny. It's not... It's almost a little bit tongue-in-cheek, I think.
Oh, it's totally.
And I love it. It to me, it definitely feels like a homage to a Tarantino movie mixed with like a Coen Brothers. It's got that same sort of like, if you put a Tarantino movie and a Coen Brothers in a food mixer and blended them together, you get this movie. So, yeah, just brilliant. It's hard to do this, and I think it's hard to act so hurt authentically, but these actors have to act hurt for probably 2/3 of the movie. So, yeah, brilliant. Really enjoyed this. I thought it was really clever.
What I liked about it is also that during its very short running time, somehow it really manages to flesh out each of these characters as being very three-dimensional. So, you know, the Charlize Copley character is, as you would expect, just really, really prone to, you know, losing his cool. And the Armie Hammer character is the super suave, you know, nothing bothers him, you know, so what, you know, he has two bullets in his leg, you know, big deal kind of. So everybody's kind of playing their chop, playing to their strengths.
Yeah.
And yet they kind of develop these characters. There's some double crosses and triple crosses and...
Double crosses.
Double crosses. And I
misunderstandings. I mean, I love that really it's all based off of... I mean, the best movie, sorry to interrupt. It's just like, it's based on, the trouble starts because of a misunderstanding, and that's always the best reason for something like this to start, right? Because it starts over something so ridiculous.
Because it would have been so easy for this movie to just be somebody's, you know, film school project, you know, about, you know, 70 shoot 'em ups. But it's more than that. It's funny and it's not lazy, and the script really builds, and I really didn't know where it was going to end, and I kind of didn't expect, you know, who's going to walk out of this, who's not going to walk out of this. So it's a work of quite a craft, I think. It's quite a work of quite some artistry.
Yeah, and you don't build allegiance for any of the characters, right? No. You almost want all of them to survive. It's losing any of them would be
right
by that point in time.
But they're all equally despicable.
That's
as well.
What I'm saying. But you don't. It does this very clever thing of rooting for everyone, yet rooting for no one.
Yeah, and I think what's happened is this movie, it showed up in a lot of film festivals, I think, and it was very buzzy, as it should have been. And so by the time it came to the cinemas, you know, it didn't get a big release, but the movie lovers community really made, you know, propped up this movie as being quite incredible. So I think a lot of people who saw it later on were kind of, they came out kind of, you know, underwhelmed by it. Although I don't possibly see how you can be underwhelmed by Free Fire. I mean, there's nothing underwhelming about this movie.
Yeah.
But I know of at least two people who said, you know, people were raving about it. It's nothing special.
You have to go in without expectations. And I feel like I did. I didn't see any of the trailers. Right. And it's so important to not see the trailer of this movie. I mean, even listening to this review is probably a little bit more than you want to know, because the trailer gives away so many of the movie's kind of... It's a movie that's got some kind of cheeky dialogue and some, you know, kind of very stylish, overplayed dialogue. You know, I mean, I think the dialogue isn't necessarily realistic if one wants to kind of, it's kind of trying to be too clever in many ways. But to give away those moments as part of a trailer is an absolute disaster. So, you know, boo to the trailer people for ruining another movie.
Yeah.
Because I think I went in there with very little expectation.
Right.
I didn't know what the movie's premise was. I didn't know anything about the movie. And I enjoyed it all the more for that.
Yeah. I mean, like Yazzie said, this is pretty efficient at 85 minutes. I mean, more films run over closer to 2 hours these days than, you know, the 1.5 hour mark. And this is just under 1.5 hours. So I feel like it goes in and it does its job very efficiently. And I think this has the makings of like a cult classic. You know, I think people who are going to love it like us are going to absolutely love it and watch it again and buy a copy of it. But I think you're right, Yazdi. I think it depends on what you go in with around your expectations. So go in with low expectations and hopefully you'll be blown away.
Yeah, and the other thing I also wanted to mention is that you cannot overestimate how blissfully perfect the editing is in this movie.
Yes.
It's just razor sharp, particularly because, again, I don't want to give too much away, but this is a one set movie. Everything happens on one location. This could be a stage play.
Yeah.
Yes.
This could
great
be
point.
Completely a stage play. Yeah, it felt that way. And to create a real sense of geography, I knew who is hiding on what part and who's doing where and who's going up the steps and who is burning and all this stuff. And it really creates this very finely choreographed sense of action.
And inventive. They use props
very inventive.
Quite inventively at times, I thought, which was good.
Yeah. So it's, I don't know, it almost feels like to me like a fight to the death Western, which is set like in a 70s warehouse. That's my closest definition I come to it. And if that doesn't make you giddily happy, then maybe you should not watch this movie, but everybody else should.
Anything else on this one?
No, again, performance is a top notch throughout. I mean, I think this movie is incredibly well cast.
Yes.
You know, I think Brie Larson here is so much fun to watch.
Yeah.
And, you know, she kind of garnered world attention last year with Room and her Oscar.
Yeah.
But what a fun
and
role.
Much better than in King Kong. Kong Skunk,
no.
Skunk,
no,
Skunk.
As
much
good.
Better than
as
Kong
good.
Skull Island.
As good. I mean, see, I loved her in Short Term 12 and I was delirious that she won the Oscar for Room. But I would have never guessed that her career would take the path of an action heroine. And she's not your prototypical action heroine, but she keeps it together.
Oh, she's got girl power in this one, which I love.
I'm sure she fought with many other people to get this role, but whoever greenlit her for this, kudos
fantastic.
To them.
Fantastic. Yeah, yeah, I agree. So,
and Sholto Copley just...
Sholto Copley.
I love the man. I love this man. Sorry, it, Joe. I love Charlie Buckley.
He just makes me laugh.
He's got that really. So he came to fame with District 9, yeah. which is a movie I loved the heck out of.
Yeah.
I think he stayed with Neil Blomkamp for the last couple of movies as well, including Elysium and. What was the other one? The one about the robot that you guys seem to like.
No, I liked and you guys hated.
Oh, my God. So
Chappie.
Chappie, yeah.
Oh, my God.
But he's still Sharlto Copley. And I think, I feel bad for the guy because he's got this very specific sensibility that no one else can do. And it feels like bad acting, but...
No.
No.
it's just very committed... Creepy acting.
Yes.
You know, which looks like bad acting, but he's so committed that you don't realize it's very deliberate.
That's a very nice way of putting it, yes.
Yeah.
I don't see him winning any Oscars anytime soon. But
poor guy, yeah.
Yeah.
Terrific stuff. Okay, so wrapping up then. Okay, I'll go first then. So really a very clever, fun little movie, as we've all said. I think it's carried by its cast because I think many of the lines of dialogue that we see in this movie require a little finesse in delivering. I think it could go wrong in so many ways, but it doesn't. It's deftly handled. It's very, very tightly edited. It's fun right through to the end. So I'm going to give this an 8 out of 10 and I can't wait to see it again.
Very, very, very easy. 8 out of 10. I'm tempted to give it even a 9 out of 10. I had so much fun, but I won't. 8.5, which I'm going to back down to 8 out of 10. Equally inspired by Tarantino and Scorsese. Has a little
Guy
bit...
Guy Ritchie.
Yeah, Guy Ritchie has a little bit of The Raid in it. I kind of sensed a little bit of The Raid in it. But just more fun than a movie like this has any right to be. It's smart, it's inventive, it's funny, it's violent, it's mean, and it has... many of things up its sleeve. Go watch this one. One of the better films of the year this year, easily.
Yeah, this is great. Easily an 8 out of 10 for me. I love this movie.
Yeah.
Grand stuff. And it came out of nowhere, seemingly, at least for me.
I remember seeing an ad in one of the screeners that we went to, one of the screenings that we went to, and I was excited just because of Sharlto Copley and Armie Hammer, who I love, and I... like the style that it was showing, it didn't show us much. But I tried not to read anything about it.
Grand. Okay, so let's take it to the end of the podcast then. So let us know what you think. Mail at movieworlders.com, twitter.com/movieworlders, facebook.com/movieworlders as well. We'll be back very soon, it seems, with some much-anticipated movies,
yes.
including Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Volume 2?
Yes, Volume 2.
So, and Alien Covenant, I think, is coming up soon, which I'm very excited to watch.
Alien.
I knew when I sent that invite out, I got 2 replies, the quickest I've ever received replies from you two.
Oh, for sure. I mean,
yeah.
It's interesting because what I've seen of the material, and I did break and watch the trailer for this one, so it doesn't seem to be too much of a direct follow-on from Prometheus. Mm-mm. So I'll be interested to see where they take this universe next. And Ridley Scott at the helm,
Ridley
I think
Scott
it's going to be such
yeah.
a this is where the man belongs, space and sci-fi. This is where he does his best work. So I've got high hopes for that. All right, let's wrap it up. Until our next podcast. Too many movies, too little time. A goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.